Calling state affairs to order after robust non-state affairs related off-the-record conversation. It's 3:12 p.m. It's Thursday, March 31, 2022. We're in the Max Schoenberg Room of the Alaska Capitol. Members present from my left to right, Representatives Vance, Tarr, Kaufman, Eastman, Story, and Klayman. Myself, Chair Christ Tompkins, gives us 7 members present, quorum to conduct business. Thank you so much to Sophia, House Records, for keeping record of today's meeting. She's working remotely today, as well as Lydia in the back of the room for facilitating the meeting from the LIO, and as well as Jeff Stepp, of course, our fearless and faithful committee aide. 2 items on today's agenda, the SB 7 and HB 226, a couple of housekeeping items before we get there. We have an amendment deadline for HB 251 submitted to Ledge Legal Saturday 5 p.m. For both HB 251 relating to Board of Trustees for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation sponsored by Representative Josephson, as well as HB 142 related to PFD eligibility sponsored by Representative Cardi. And just a note, so those are submission of Ledge Legal deadlines. If you don't get it back by when we have our next hearing because legal is backed up, you will not be penalized for that. We will move hearings and be flexible accordingly because we want to be clear-eyed and realistic about legal's capacity in this time of operating budget and operating budget amendments. Second note is HB 124 is not on today's agenda relating to filling a vacancy in the legislature, although I do anticipate that to be back before the committee, hopefully in the not-too-distant future. So that takes us to SB 7, sponsored by Senator Gray Jackson, who is in the room. And Senator, you're welcome to make any introductory remarks. And from there, we can go to public testimony, take stock of amendments, although none were submitted, and then consider final action. Welcome, Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Senator L.V. Gray Jackson, representing District I in Anchorage. And thank you to the committee also for hearing my bill for a second time. Just as a refresher, this bill, Senate Bill 7, will require that the Department of Public Safety on their website, in the department's current policies and procedures related to the conduct of peace officers employed or regulated by the department, that these policies be on the website. It's the duty of the Department of Public Safety to ensure public safety within our communities, and as such, the public must be able to easily access current policies and procedures. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. I just want to jump right into public testimony at this time, which was noticed, so I will go ahead and open public testimony. Don't believe anybody in the room is here to testify in SB 7, so we will go to those online and working from the top of the queue per my iPad interface to the bottom. We have Lisa Rush in Anchorage. Welcome, Lisa. Go ahead, put yourself on record and present your testimony on SB 7 in 2 or fewer minutes.
Yes. One moment here. Okay. All right. Okay, can you hear me?
We can hear you, yes.
Okay, thank you. Hello, my name is Senator Gray Jackson, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Rush. I represent the Alaska Black Caucus. We are located in Anchorage. The Alaska Black Caucus advocates for Black, Indigenous, and other people of color, lives, and livelihood across Alaska. We are committed to eliminating all forms of racial prejudice, keeping the public aware of the adverse effects of racial, educational, political, and economic discrimination, and revolving the take on all affirmative and necessary actions to secure and ensure the elimination of all forms of prejudices. On behalf of the Alaska Black Caucus, I am calling in support of SB 7, an act requiring the Department of Public Safety to publish certain policies and procedures on the department's internet website. According to research, studies have shown that public access to information about how law enforcement agencies make critical organizational decisions and the outcomes of those decisions has the potential to increase and, increase public and organizational accountability, encourage citizen encouragement, and promote trust between the police and the communities they serve. Constituents are aware of organizational influences, such as police chiefs, beginning with their efforts on the behavior of police officers. Yet a chief most profound influence may be cultural. Therefore, effective police leaders must work to establish a culture of transparency and accountability in order to build public trust and accountability. Research has also shown a clear link between a citizen's trust and a confidence in the police and the willingness of the willingness to voluntarily comply with the law or provide support to oncoming crime investigations. The Alaska Black Caucus supports this legislation by sharing information with the public to strengthen police community relations and doing so to give the public true insight into the department's operational decision making and facts about the outcomes of their choices. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Seeing no questions, we'll go to the next testifier in the queue, Casey Kasort in Fairbanks. If you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and present your testimony in two or fewer minutes.
Will do. My name is Casey Kasort, and I'm a lifelong Fairbanks resident calling in today on behalf of myself. I'm here to testify in support of SB 7, which would require the Department of Public Safety to make their policies and procedures public on their website. Tomorrow will be 3 years since Bashar Hassan was murdered by Anchorage police officers who shot him 12 times and fired more than 21 times and failed to administer any medical help for several minutes while he was lying on the ground. We only know so much about that situation since the dash cam footage was finally released years after the murder happened, but we know that police brutality is a deadly problem here in Alaska, so I'm really glad that you're hearing this bill today. Frankly, making these policies and procedures publicly accessible is the barest of minimums that we can do to provide basic transparency around policing in Alaska. I would love to see the entire suite of police reform bills that was introduced by Senator Gray Jackson and the companion bills introduced by Representative Tarr pass the Alaska legislature to make our state safer for everyone. I hope that SB 7 does pass as a first step in the right direction. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for taking the time to testify. Next in the queue, Michael Garvey in Anchorage. If you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and present your testimony in two or fewer minutes.
Thank you. For the record, I am Michael Garvey, Advocacy Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska, calling in support of Senate Bill 7. SB 7 is part of Senator Gray Jackson's package of police reform legislation that would address vital elements of police and police community relations, like the kinds of force police are allowed to use, when de-escalation must be used, the obligation of officers to intervene to stop misconduct, and transparency. SB 7 furthers the transparency goals of this package. It builds community trust for the public to know how police are trained or told to act in a specific situation and what guidelines for conduct officers need to follow. Officers interact with the public every day and are taxpayer-funded public servants. We should be able to know the conduct standards they must meet so we can be sure they're doing their job properly. Transparency is also a building block for accountability when police misconduct does occur. In the event a member of the public witnesses or experiences officer misconduct, they should be able to know how the officer was required to act in the course of seeking accountability. We see the frustration and distrust that are created when communities are not able to easily access police policies and records. We've seen it in Nome, Fairbanks, and Anchorage, to name a few. SB 7 is a concrete step the legislature can take to counter that distrust and should be the first of many taken toward greater transparency in law enforcement across the state. We commend Senator Gray Jackson for introducing SB 7 and other pieces of police reform legislation, and thank Representative Tarr for carrying these bills in the House. Thank you to the committee for hearing SB 7, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Moving next in the queue, and forgive any mispronunciation, Christine Allison in Wasilla. If you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and present your testimony in two or fewer minutes.
Thank you. My name is Christiane Joy Allison. I am a resident of Wasilla, Alaska, and I am speaking for myself. January 23rd of 2009, I was brutally tortured emotionally and mentally by two Alaska State Troopers. This year marks 13 years since that day. I was tortured with autopsy photos of my child cut up into pieces, and I have had a lot of difficulty since that experience. It has been my experience in the 13 years since that occurred to me that there is very little transparency as far as what police officers are and are not allowed to do, and there is even less accountability for the ability to follow up and demand that justice be done and that citizens be protected. I have taken numerous steps since that time to try and ensure that a young bereaved parent like myself, who was only 22 years old at the time, that another mother would never have to experience what I went through in the circumstances that I was facing. But I've made very little headway. I believe that the posting of public policies empower the people to be able to seek accountability and be able to go to the authorities and say, this was what was required, yet this was what my experience was, and I expect someone to be held accountable. And so I would encourage this body to take this very, very seriously and understand that it is people like me that don't have the power to be able to hold folks accountable and to have justice done for myself, for my family, and for my child who passed away, without policies like this in place and without accountability to the public. So thank you very much for allowing me to give my testimony today.
Thank you for taking the time to testify. I actually have a question, Ms. Allison. Could you describe a little bit more what you referenced happening 11 years ago vis-a-vis the autopsy photos? I'm not sure I was able to sort of infer what that situation might have been.
So my daughter passed away due to a household fall, and the state made an accusation against my husband related to a junk science accusation called shaken baby syndrome. I was not home at the time that my daughter fell. I was in Anchorage, and my daughter was injured when she fell down in Wasilla. But in an effort to forcibly turn me against my spouse and to force me to believe that their theory of the case was correct, they subjected me to extremely, extremely graphic photos for 4 straight hours. They, at one point, about 2 hours into the interrogation, the officer broke and actually started screaming and yelling at me and coming across the table and telling me that I wasn't a good mother and I didn't love my child if I wouldn't look. And no matter how much I begged them to stop, they were not going to allow me to leave that room until I agreed with them. And eventually, at the 4-hour point, I was able to escape the situation. I did not understand that I was allowed to leave. I did not understand that I could have gone at any point until my parents showed up and rescued me.
Thank you. I don't see any further questions from the committee. Thank you for taking the time to testify. And I don't see anyone else in the queue online to testify. So at this time, I'm going to close public testimony on SB 7. And that brings the bill back before the committee. There was an amendment deadline. It came and gone, and no amendments were submitted. So at this time, we can take the bill back before the committee for any final questions for the sponsor, or we also have the state troopers online available for questions as well. Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, any closing comments? Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as I've been working with Senator Gray Jackson on this, it's so challenging because we're so supportive of our public safety professionals. And then in the circumstances where something doesn't go the way it was supposed to, recognize the importance of having transparency and ways to improve things, and just very impacted by the testimony of Ms. Allison in terms of how difficult that must have been. And so just wanted to say thank you to her for reminding us that we can always, you know, do things better and make the system work a little bit better for people, particularly in those times of difficulty and pain and stress. And I hope that's what we'll accomplish here through this legislation.
Thank you. Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And through the Chair, thank you, Senator Gray Jackson, for bringing this forward. I think it is so important at this time to continue to build and improve trust between members of the public and our public safety officials and departments. So I appreciate your efforts, and I, too, thank the courage it took for sharing of that story just now. Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. You know, I acknowledge that it appears the department is already doing most, if not all, of this currently. So I'm not entirely sure that it needs to be placed in statute. But I also wanted to make mention of the fact that it does reference here in the bill VPSOs. And I understand that, you know, there may be some policies involving VPSOs that aren't actually promulgated by the Department of Public Safety. So, you know, perhaps there, you know, is benefit at some point in this process after the bill leaves committee of making sure for consistency and transparency that if there are policies involving VPSOs that aren't put forward by the department, that those also would be disclosed, so that there's no expectation that all the VPSO policies are disclosed. But since the requirement only is on the department's policies, there may be a gap there.
Thank you. And seeing no further comment, a motion, Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oops. I move to report SB 7 version 32-LS0058-B out of committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal notes.
Seeing and hearing no objection, the motion to move SB 7 version /B from State Affairs carries with individual recommendations soon to be memorialized by the paperwork that will circulate as we keep going. So next up on the agenda, thank you, Senator Gray Jackson.
Chairman and committee.
Is HB 226 from Representative Josephson. This is a first hearing, and here in the room is Representative Josephson, as well as staff to Rep. Josephson, Catherine Reardon, as well as, I believe, online, Elise Sorum-Burke in Representative Josephson's office, and we can dive right in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Andy Josephson. I represent District 17 in Midtown Anchorage. With me is Catherine Reardon, and also with me is Elise Sorum-Burke. She is in our multimedia presentation. I wanted to give the committee some idea of why we're here, and then we will go through Ms. Sorum-Burke's PowerPoint, and we will answer questions. The first thing is that under Title 39, when we look at increasing salaries for some sectors of the unorganized employees, that has to be done statutorily. So it can be done through bonuses, and that was a hot item in House Finance last week. There was a dispute about how that would happen. It clearly can happen. But it's the way of getting there. Bonuses are, I think, effective in terms of staunching the bleeding caused by turnover and inability to retain workers, but it's not a permanent solution. No one thinks that it is. This bill focuses on attorneys exclusively, and that does beg the question, why? Because there are other kinds of partially exempt workers. And my fast answer to that is, partly through my work in this building, that's what I've been exposed to more as the chairman of the Department of Law Finance Subcommittee. And I've heard the Department of Law in particular make very serious or raise very serious concerns about its ability to attract and retain attorneys. And I also believe that, as the chairman is likely to agree, things move very, very slowly and painfully through this building sometimes. Sometimes they can move rapidly. Earlier today, I attended a rally on an issue that's been before the legislature for a decade. And so I looked at this and I said, what is my role? Well, this is something I know about as an attorney that I can relate to. And what I heard from the Department of Law in particular was that they had a crisis. Part of what has typically happened, at least in the last decade, is that when the general government unit receives an increase, the powers that be on the third floor in particular try to track that development and match it for their attorneys. In the height of our recession, FY 17 to 19, no one got, I can't say no one, but no one in the GGU, the supervisory unit, exempt, partially exempt, et cetera, got any raises at all of this sort. They would get merit pay increases, likely, but not wage increases to reflect the cost of living. What happened in FY 20 was that the general government unit returned to getting an increase, and they got, through their collective bargaining agreement, 5% over three, spread out over 3 years. The attorneys got none. So what's happened is the attorneys have seen no increases under Title 39 since FY 16. Now, the problem with that is it's put them way behind a place where they could be a competitive in the market. This, to begin with, the first thing that I would comment on, and then I really will, in fairly short order, get this over to Ms. Soren Burke, is we learned in January, for example, that the starting salary for a new state attorney is $62,000. The starting salary for a municipality of Anchorage attorney is $85,000. So we start in a $23,000 hole relative to at least one major municipality. We learned that in the civil division, there are 15 vacant attorney positions and 18 in active recruitment. In the civil division, there were 22 attorney hires in the civil division for 2021 alone and 17 attorney exits. So they come and then they churn out and go. In the criminal division, there were 21 vacant attorney positions and 12 are in active recruitment. Deputy Attorney General Skidmore highlighted in his presentation this year that in 2021, there was a 20.6% turnover in prosecutor positions, and 17% of prosecutor positions were vacant as of January 2022. We also learned that in the child protection unit, and what we tend to see, although it's not exclusively true, but in those sectors of our public attorneys that are most understandably arduous and challenging emotionally and the like. So this would be the prosecutors, but also the child protection unit. There's incredible turnover. The child protection unit testified that they are staffing some rural and Fairbanks offices out of Anchorage. They simply can't fill the positions. We learned separately that in the workers' comp division of the state of Alaska, that many of the workers' comp cases are simply hired out contractually, because they just can't hire state attorneys to do the work. The data from the American Bar Association returning to the Child Protection Unit supports that pre-COVID, the average case rate was about 90, where it is recommended that it be 60. And now that has improved, but only because OCS's workload arguably has improved due to COVID and fewer reports. May I read a couple emails that I've received on this topic?
Briefly.
Okay. A high-ranking member of the Department of Law noted that the failure to recognize the pay issues at law has had a predictable effect, substantial turnover and recruitment difficulties in both the civil and criminal divisions. There are other factors, of course, but pay is an obvious major factor and has real consequences. The state needs skilled attorneys to prosecute crimes, provide child protection, and advise and defend the state on the multitude of matters in the civil arena. And it moves on in that manner. So at issue is the quality of our capacity to prosecute crimes and to protect our children. I have given the committee, or rather Ms. Reardon gave the committee and Mr. Stepp obliged, a packet that shows some of the key features that we were given in subcommittee this year. And I commend that to you because of the severe situation that's noted there. And I would highlight that, for example, at page 2, a National District Attorneys Association salary study said that they recommended starting salaries of $87,000. Ours, again, is $62,000. At page 3 of that packet that you received, you see the marked and alarming number of prosecutor positions that have turned over. And page 4 and 5 are also supportive of my thesis that this is unsustainable for the state's attorney class. And finally, I just wanted to highlight a couple other things. This was something that was stark and I thought dramatic. We learned from Ms. Corey Mills, the Deputy Attorney General, that since 2018, 93 attorneys have left the civil division out of 143 positions. She had one opening for 106 months. So we clearly have a problem. Attorneys are not going to tolerate, note that they have, that many of them want to buy a home someday. They have young families. They have student loans. They're not going to tolerate this sort of salary. And so our proposal is for a 10% increase in House Bill 226. And I will tell the committee that I think that's insufficient, because you simply do the math and you say, well, what's 10% of $62,000? Well, that's $6,200. So what's the salary? $68,000. How does that compare to the municipality of Anchorage? Not well. So we, because of the recession and the freezing of these increases, and then because this fell off everyone's radar, it just keeps slipping back and back and back. And so that's why I've offered this bill. The last thing I'll say, I promise, is that in our budget, the operating budget, there are bonuses. There are ways to secure those bonuses. I think that one of the ways, according to our attorneys up the hill, is to do something called a temporary act. That would validate the legislature's intent to pay the bonuses. And there's some belief that you can't just say, here's a bonus. You have to do this exercise. But I don't know whether those will hold through the process. And so this is a two-pronged attack on the problem. With that, I'll answer any questions or move on to the PowerPoint.
Thank you. We can move on to the PowerPoint, but I'm not a fan of overly unidirectional bill presentations. So, Ms. Sorum Burke, if you can limit your presentation to slides that represent new material, and then we can transition to committee dialogue, that would be terrific. So, Ms. Sorum Burke, over to you.
Hello, Elise Thornburg for the record, staff to Representative Josephson. Good afternoon, Chair Fice Tompkins and members of the committee. I will spend the majority of my time on slide 2 of the bill. So I'll walk briefly through what the bill does, section by section. You have before you a bill of 9 sections. There is really one section of this bill that is at its core, but I'll just briefly walk through what the other sections of the bill do. So sections 1 through 3 of the bill are technical changes made by our legal drafters to AS 39.27.011 that reflect the current reality of what partially exempt and exempt employees' salary schedules look like. So in Section 1, you have an update of the pay scale you find in statute to the rate established in calendar year 2015, fiscal year 2016. Sections 2 and 3 reflect history, basically reflecting that updates to that salary schedule occurred in 2014 and 2015. So Section 4 of the bill simply adds new subsection L to the existing AS39.27.011K, which has to do with employees on a case-by-case basis being able to make above a certain amount on the salary schedule. Section 5 is really the core component of the bill. And this is the portion of the bill that is making the legal change that Representative Josephson was referring to. So what Section 5 does is it increases pay for state attorneys under AS39.25.120C3 by 10%. So that definition, if you look up in this on the slide before you, these are attorney members of the Department of Law, the Public Defender Agency, and the Office of Public Advocacy in the Department of Administration. So next slide, please. Okay, I can skip over, slide 3, since Representative Josephson spoke to this already, and then moving on to slide 4. So, are we on slide 4?
We are, yes.
Okay. Maybe it's just a slight lag in the video. Okay, so slide 4, this is an audio piece from KUAC from a couple of years ago that I encourage committee members to look up and listen to. The point of this is, beyond all of the reasons that Representative Josephson attested to, this is not just a state employee issue. This is an occupational-wide issue in the state. In this piece, the then president of the Alaska Bar Association attested to how an aging group of members of the bar in the state was going to fairly imminently lead to a shortage of lawyers. And a quote from that is, if the bar isn't growing as fast as lawyers are retiring, that will lead to a shortage of lawyers. And that is something we are definitely seeing in Alaska, and the state is having a very hard time competing with the private sector and even with other governmental organizations. One thing that Rep. Josephson didn't really touch on was that we also heard about attorneys leaving state service to work for the federal government because the federal government pays significantly more, and our Department of Law lost some attorneys to the federal government as well. Next slide, please. So this is a reference to the salary report that Representative Josephson spoke to previously. And this is just kind of showing where the median salary is for Anchorage and what the recommended salary would be. Note that for a state employee, they would be below the median as a attorney 1 or 2 with the state. And next slide, please. So there are other lawyers who work for the state other than the ones who we are dealing with in this bill as it's currently drafted. We have talked about the possibility of including some of the exempt legal support positions in the department law. So one of those classes is associate attorneys. They aren't actually attorneys. It's a weird naming issue. Administrative law judge positions are another example of attorneys who aren't covered by how the bill is currently drafted. And then workers' compensation hearing officers and adjudicators are another example. So if it were the will of the committee, we could also look into adding, seeing, if there are classes who are also struggling in a way that's similar to the Department of Law, for fairness across the board. And next slide, that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sorenberg. Representative Josephson?
One comment?
Yes.
I know the chair, I believe the chair wants to see in the process of lawmaking that there's real there's real potential for success. And I can share with the chair and the committee, and rather than getting to the details, the administration has indicated unequivocally that it wants to increase attorney pay. Absolutely unequivocally. So this would not be met. I can't speak to this 10% rate, which I think is probably too low, with a full agreement or acquiescence. But we're on the same page.
Certainly resonant with me. Questions from the committee? I think there's note passing, but I think a question from Representative Eastman.
Thank you. You know, I think dealing with this bill up to this point in the process, the argument I think has been made pretty strongly that it is a cumbersome and slow process to adjust these salary rates in statute. And I'm wondering what would need to happen so that we don't need to do that in the future. I know they're looking at the sponsor statement talks about, you know, these amounts not being changed since 2015. Inflation is a factor, even if you were starting off at a good rate to begin with. 15 to 22, even past this year, 7 years, it seems like a long time to adjust an amount. How do we fix this process?
You know, may I ask Ms. Reardon to chime in? She's going to be surprised by that. But she's been an administrative services director, and I bet she has some insight into this issue.
I know Ms. Reardon to be a font of state government wisdom. So,
For the record, this is Catherine Reardon, aide to Representative Josephson, and yes, that was a surprise.
No pressure.
Yeah, it just seems like a wonderful opportunity to have a valuable opinion. you know, I think it's as you all know, it's that balance between legislative oversight and executive branch, you know, ability to take initiative and solve problems quickly. You know, I personally think that since the legislature does have the appropriation power and does decide how much total personal services you're going to get in a department, that perhaps you could consider legislation that gave a little more leeway through either regulation, if there need to be, you know, more of a public process, or other such processes to make their own adjustments within the partially exempt category. But I will reflect on this more if there's greater interest in what my opinion might be. Thank you.
Follow up.
Thank you. Well, you know, I'm only one office, but I can say that there is great interest in my one office. So if you do have any further insights, would welcome those. And next question. So I see in the title of the bill, it talks about public officials. Which public officials are impacted by this bill?
The public officials that are impacted are in a single subsection of Title 39, and in the slide deck it says this applies to attorneys in subsection C3 of 39.25.120. Those who would be impacted, I think to their great benefit, would be attorney members of the staff of the Department of Law, the Public Defender Agency, the Office of Public and the Office of Public Advocacy in the Department of Administration.
Follow up.
And can you help me understand what is it about those particular individuals that makes them fall under the public officials category as opposed to attorney or staff and a non-public official category? I mean, I understand the other portions of the title. It's just the public officials reference was struck out at me.
I might ask Ms. Reardon again for her expertise on that.
Mr. Chair, this is Catherine Reardon. I believe that, your question comes from the way the partially exempt statute reads that this fits into. So in general, you know, the statute will say they're all of the classified employees subject to collective bargaining, and here are rules that govern them. And then public officials who fit in the following categories are exempt from certain aspects of the Personal Act, but not others. That's why they're partially exempt. And they have to be listed, it says, including the following public officials. And it has things like the executive directors of the medical board and things like that. It says the division directors. It says the deputy commissioners of major departments. And then one of these categories is that quote that Representative Josephson gave about attorney members. So public officials is their general term for all the types, the little sections and subsections of partially exempt employees. Did that?
That's helpful.
It all help?
Thank you. I know it's complicated.
Other questions, Representative Vance?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. To the bill sponsor, I do appreciate this legislation as well. But I'd like more comparative information. Like, we have the information from about a retention in the Department of Law in over the years, you know, like 20%, 30%. Could you provide, you know, in the future, some information about the retention that, say, the municipality of Anchorage has for similar positions, just to kind of get a look at what other entities who do similar things are experiencing. What is a normal rate of attrition, and what are some of the things that they're facing? Because we're comparing, you know, a salary to the municipality of Anchorage, that seems reasonable to do. You know, I wanted to kind of understand what some of the issues that they're facing internally as well. And then you have here an increase by 10%, which you mentioned is probably insufficient. I think that's a very conservative approach. Is that the amount, this roughly 6,200, is that lower than the bonuses that you put in the subcommittee process, that cumulative total?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the fast answer to the last question is yes, which is part of the reason why, as my staff and I looked at this and delved into it, we concluded that this was such a crisis that we had to do something now. Of course, you sat on that subcommittee, and that was an amount that, given our financial circumstances, and they can be debatable or debated, they're certainly better, but they can still be debated, that was affordable to staunch the bleeding, as I said. Yes, the attorney's fees, rather the attorney's salary increases were $10,000 in the budget. They are only for the Department of Law. There was consideration to offering an amendment for OPA attorneys and OPA attorneys and PD attorneys. That didn't happen in the end. It probably needs to. I will say the Department of Law was much more effusive, but this is more of a, this would be longer lasting. It would be in statute, right? So this is an opportunity to cover all those folks at the same time and the same rate. And I would say, relative to Representative Eastman's question, although this isn't quite what he asked, when Ms. Reardon noted that under 3925.120, there's this list of all these public officers, I don't have as intimate knowledge of the work they do, but with great respect for our deputy commissioners, I know that many of them make approaching $200,000. And I think that's a living wage. And I wouldn't begrudge them making $220,000, I guess, but I don't see that as a crisis, and this is.
Follow up. So because of seeing that the 10% is pretty nominal comparatively to what you would like to reach for a comparative salary that that we're competing in retaining these, would you provide a chart that shows what the salaries would be for 10%, 15%, 20%, so that we can take a look at what that would be and have some, I'd like to have options on what we could look at as we look at our long-term fiscal plan and really the goal of retaining these attorneys, because I can't imagine how much it's costing and the time to train people coming in and then to lose them so quickly. And that's costing us in money in the justice system as well. So I agree with you that I think the 10% is not enough, but I also want to be wise in what the long-term impact is going to be and what's possible. So I'd appreciate kind of a bigger picture of what that would look like and hopefully soon a fiscal note as well.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, we've done, my office has done yeoman work to calculate what the fiscal note is likely to show at 10%. It's going to be in the range of $5 million for all three agencies. Your requests are very easily met. There was some other point I was going to share. But, yes, we can do those things for you.
Thank you.
I was just going to say there was a reference to a long-term fiscal plan, and that only elicited questions for me. I didn't know we had one. Representative Klayman.
Just so that I understand it, in Section 1 and in Section 1 of the bill, there's a whole new salary schedule that would take effect on the effective date. How much, what does that reflect as an increase from the current levels?
Mr. Chair, Representative Klayman, I'm going to invite Elise Sorenberg to answer that question.
Ms. Sorenberg.
Yes, thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. Elise Sorenberg for the record again. Through the Chair, Representative Klayman, as I alluded to in my sectional, Sections 1 through 3 are not making changes to current salary schedule. So if you open up a statute book currently and you look at what the salary schedule is, that is going to be what was adopted by the legislature in 2013. And then if you look further down the page to AS 39.27.011E, that will reflect the update that happened in calendar year 2014, and F will reflect the update that happened in calendar year 2015. So essentially, sections 1 through 3 are not updating the salary, they're not increasing the salary schedule at all. They're updating that salary schedule in section 1 to reflect our current reality. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you. Follow up. And I recognize I'm a co-sponsor of this bill, and I strongly support it, but I also have additional questions because, I think about only a 10% increase, and I recognize there's other state employees that probably we should be looking at this as well, but many of those are actually in bargaining units, and so the bargaining units have the ability to get increases that may not be available here, but I often feel like this is where you go buy a computer that's 3 years old and you take it home and you turn it on and then you call for assistance to the place and they say, oh, well, that operating system is 3 years old and we don't service it anymore. what are we going to do? And so I see the 10%, which doesn't take effect until next July, as a very much a step in the right direction. But I kind of think this isn't going to go very A 10% increase with the inflation that we're seeing isn't going to go very far towards addressing the hiring problems that we're having today. And I just wonder whether we should be thinking about a greater increase and whether we should be looking at increase on an earlier effective date as a co-sponsor of the bill.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, those are consistent with the bill, friendly amendments, all of those responses. And if I could, Mr. Chairman, this is, I've been I think what I was going to say to Representative Vance, I've been subcommittee chair, I think, 4 years now, and this is just an ongoing problem. This is we get these slide decks every year, and finally the subcommittee said we're tired of it, and I filed this bill in addition. And what the department reports is they're doing things like fellowships. I'm a fan of fellowships. They are recruiting 3Ls, third year law students. That's not unheard of, but they have folks they offer jobs to who haven't passed the bar. Some of them fail the bar. They're young, they're inexperienced. Everyone starts out young and inexperienced, but this is a chronic problem and it's not going to go away.
Thank you, Representative Justison. A couple of comments. First, Representative Kaufman is presenting HB 187 in this committee and the other body, so he'll be back whenever that bill presentation is done. I just want to associate myself with Representative Klayman's comments and questions, and also Representative Eastman's question about executive branch flexibility. I feel like that could be something worth pursuing or sort of in the mix. And last, I'm going to go briefly ease while I pass the gavel to Representative Klayman while I step out of the room for a few minutes. Ready?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, am I understanding correctly that we would have to increase our salary by approximately 40% in order to be reciprocal to the municipality of Anchorage salary for their attorneys?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, yes. But that would be for the lowest rung on each respective ladder. And I don't know whether, I mean, there are attorneys that make, through my lens, a good living practicing law for the state, but they get poached before, more and more before they get to that level. But your math is correct. And I will say when I met with Ms. Soren Burke, I mean, that's unofficial. We share an office. But when we spoke about this, I identified a number, like you said, and I said, this will be unpalatable to either the committee or the legislature. But it's a real number.
Follow up?
Representative Vance.
In my previous question, I asked for what a scaled approach to reach that would be, and I wasn't thinking about it would have to go all the way up to 40% to be reciprocal, but in that look, could we also compare what the benefit packages are? Because sometimes the state doesn't have as high of a salary, but we have great benefits. And so I'd like to see what that fuller picture would be so that we can make sure that we're comparing apples to apples, because we want to be able to recruit and retain great attorneys and work with what Department of Law is already doing. But I do have more questions. I think that we should explore, like Representative Eastman said, more creative solutions so that we don't keep having to go through this legislative process and it seems like we're always too late. So I think that would be something that we could explore, but also, like Rep. Klayman said, taking action. But that does bring me to another question. Mr. Chairman,
Representative Vance, please.
On Section 5, Section 6 and the applicability, the Act applies to employees hired before, on, or after the effective date. Can you talk about that more, of why you worded it that way and not just moving forward?
I think I'm going to go to a lifeline and ask Ms. Soren Burke if she can help Representative Vance with that question.
Hello, Amy Swarmbrook for the record, through the chair, Representative Vance. The intent of that section is to ensure that all current state attorneys in Department of Law, OPA, and Office of and Public Defender Agency are covered. So It's a question of fairness. You know, if you have someone who comes on now who gets hired right now and then this bill goes into effect in July,
you don't want to implement an entirely new salary schedule for just new employees. We want this to apply to existing employees and new employees.
Thank you.
And through the chairs, Representative Vance, I'm losing it again.
Why don't we take a brief at ease and I'll pass the gavel back. At ease.
Every minute. For consideration of this bill, Representative Joseph.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, all I'll say is that your requests will be something we'll meet, and they're excellent questions, and we'll get the answers you need.
Thank you.
Representative Klayman.
On the same note, I know during the Department of Law budget subcommittees, we also heard about starting salaries in Washington State in the Attorney General's office. And I'd actually be interested, not to make too much work for you, but I'd be interested in having that comparison in addition, along with the Anchorage salaries for the Anchorage Municipal Prosecutors, and well, not just prosecutors, but Anchorage Municipal Department of Law. I'd be interested in having a comparison with Washington State and the state of Oregon, because they're sort of the two states closest to ours, and I think places that we're directly competing with attorneys to come up here. And I think in addition to the salary, I would like to know just whether they are on a 401k-style retirement plan or a pension-style retirement plan, because I do think historically one of the things that would cause people to say, well, I'll become a public lawyer and make a career in there, is that their annual pay level was, particularly as they get more senior, tended not to keep pace with private industry, but their retirement package, because they had a pension and not a 401k style plan, that made staying in public service more attractive. And when you don't have that pension as part of your benefit package, so I'd be interested to see how we look when we're comparing to Washington and Oregon. I don't want to go to California because that's too big and complicated.
Through the chair, in my crib notes to prepare for finance and defend the bonuses, which are meant to parallel these, I have written down here, state of Washington, 19 attorney positions, 500 attorneys, meaning 19 vacancies. We were told by Ms. Mills there was a 3% vacancy rate, whereas, you know, there's 20% or greater in Alaska. And I would note, this is what I again meant to say to Representative Vance, on the question where she referred to flexibility that Representative Eastman noted, you know, one of the problems was that under the title, you've got to make adjustments to these PX salaries. You have to do it statutorily, typically. And we just didn't do it for 6 years. So if you can get back on step and then you're religious about it, it's a system that can work. But you got to be vigilant about it, or inflation will just erode the salary.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. In Section 5, there's that separate date of July 1st, 2023. I was wondering, could you speak more to the reason that we set aside that section individually for that delayed effectiveness?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it may be that Ms. Sorenberg has greater insight, but essentially the bill drafter did what had been done in 2013 by saying, we're going to have a new section, and the new section will simply reflect the heart of the bill, which will be this 10% increase. The effective date is interesting in that I don't know whether that was a quick decision or whether, again, we thought this was a way to coax the administration and legislators into seeing the wisdom in the bill by not, you know, implementing it too fast. But we're in a crisis. And by the way, Representative Klayman noted the defined benefit issue. That was something that I actively and repeatedly said could be considered in my defined benefit bill. However, we're so down that tunnel in terms of the actuarials and all that, that you would upset the apple cart. And but I had given it made sense given that PDs and DAs in particular are in the public safety realm to include them as sort of the first responder group, but we did chose not to do that.
Oh, we have a drafter on the line by chance?
We don't.
I guess I'll ask the question. Maybe there's not an answer right now, but it would seem to me Section 5 is written very creatively from a drafting perspective. I'm not quite sure that that comports with the drafting manual, because effectively we're creating a new effective date for Section 5, but there's no effective date clause separately to be voted on by the legislature. You're accomplishing the effect of having a new effective date or a different effective date, but maybe the clerk wouldn't know to, you know, call that out separately for a separate vote. Seems strange to me.
Through the chair, except that Section 9 says the act takes effect July 1. Of course, yes, I take your point. It then says July 1, 2022 versus 23. But it looks like Ms. Sorenberg wanted to say something.
Ms. Sorenberg.
Oh, sorry. Excuse me. I didn't know I was unmuted still. Apologies. So through the chair, Representative Eastman, so I think the point of the effective date of the act is in Section 9, and that's July 1st, 2022. What we're doing is adopting just a base salary schedule and increasing that by 10% for this subclass of employees. I think that time is built in to allow for all of the administrative tasks that need to happen between when the act is adopted and when the salary schedule goes into effect. So it's not the effective date of the act, it's rather the date at which the salary schedule takes effect.
Thank you.
Follow up.
So I see on line 18 of page 3 that we're talking about it applying to attorneys hired before, on, or after the effective date of the act. And that seems rather comprehensive. So it applies to everyone, and we're making sure to call that out. Now, since we're dealing with attorneys that were hired before this bill is coming into effect, I'm curious, and if there was, you know, an attorney on the line, I would ask them, but maybe I'll throw the question to you of something you might have considered. What about applying this bill retroactively in other respects? So this is applying retroactively in terms of attorneys that have already been hired. What about, since we're adjusting the salary amount, we're to apply that adjustment retroactively? Would that perhaps be a legal means to more constitutionally effectively add a bonus without, you know, other legal hurdles? And I know I've already said in my first question a few minutes ago that I'd like to pull this out of statute maybe, but since it's in statute and we're dealing with the amounts in statute, is there anything to preclude us from making that change apply retroactively?
Through the chair, I don't think there is. I want to be clear, though, that the bonuses, both the Department of Law and legislative legal, our attorneys, haven't, although our attorneys touch on briefly in a 10-page memo some constitutional concern, it's all remediable. It's all fixable. And bonuses are paid all the time. They're being paid today through letters of agreement. However, with PX, you need to do apparently a temporary act or some other, you need to sort of ordain them kind of thing. I think that if there was a way to craft this so that it had some retroactive effect, it would certainly be consistent with the bill's effort to stop the turnover and to indicate to the attorneys there, hang on, there's support coming. I just haven't given it enough thought.
Additional questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I'm just wondering, it's not the right words, but a sunset type of provision or something. Did you consider something like that that would prompt the legislature to have to revisit this? Not that we, you know, we don't, it's not that we don't have the opportunity anyhow, but perhaps given how you're characterizing it as it slipped off the radar, that maybe we could consider a provision that prompts attention to this matter in 5 years or something like that, because we all talk about how important public safety is, and we certainly can't have a safe state if we don't have all the pieces in place that make that happen.
Through the chair, Representative, I did not think about that. But again, generally you would see some increase virtually every year. That's Senator Keel and the other body had a very easily understood spreadsheet that sort of reflects that. Again, in FY17 through 19 inclusive, there were no increases. That was a time when, for example, the court system was freezing salaries, et cetera. So my only concern with your recommendation is it would have to be shorter than 5 years. You'd have to, you just have to stay on this. And someone has to be the watchdog. So
okay. I mean, I can look into that further. And Mr. Chairman, a follow-up? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure I understand Representative Eastman's questions. If we put the bonuses in this year, that will be the FY23. And then if this dovetails on the July 1, 2023, then that would be the FY24. So it should be like a seamless transition into this bonus then into pay raise.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, a point very well taken. I don't know why I didn't identify it. I think that it's sort of an accident, but a good one. It's fortuitous. I mean, because I see here the bill was introduced January 18th. There was some discussion of attorneys' bonuses, but then when the subcommittee process began after January 18th, you know, I think Representative Klayman and my staff and Representative Story and others just concluded that this is just what we have to do. And I'm actually wondering if you're on the subcommittee. But I think it was Representative Drummond and Representative Snyder. So I think that it's drafted in a seamless way and could be, you know, I'm afraid of what will happen in conference committee with vetoes on bonuses, et cetera. So that's why I've got this two-pronged approach.
Okay. And one final, if I could. Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, because what I think then I would want to think about, I think it was Representative Vance had an earlier question, is the bonus going to exceed what they'll get in the pay raise? And I guess what I would like us to look at then is let's make all those numbers match a little better. So, you know, if the bonus is the FY23 part of this, the FY24, they don't have to get a pay cut coming into that next year. You know, and so if maybe that means 13% or 15%, because I'm sorry, I'm unfamiliar with the amounts you put in the budget subcommittee, but then, you know, we could just kind of keep everybody on that same path. And I guess it just feels like it wouldn't be very fair to have something 1 year and then have to get a little bit of a reduction in your pay the following year if it's avoidable.
Resident Tor, that's another good point. Now, one thing I will note about the bonuses is that it's not topical for this bill because this is about attorneys, but the package that is in the budget includes a mid-range and sort of lowest rung, with great respect, staff. They also are afforded $5,000 bonuses and $3,000 bonuses respectively. And that's because the same phenomenon was happening there, right? So paralegals with great skills and training, gone to the private sector at double the salary, that sort of thing. So that was one of the reasons we arrived at, I think, a $10,000 figure on the bonuses in the budget, $5,000 for the mid-range and $3,000 for the lowest salary persons. But yes, I think that would be a reason to increase subsection 5. And have something more even.
And lastly, thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. So if your office, are you Ms. Reardon or Ms. Sternberg, able to sort of do the math on that relative to the bonuses? And then, you know, we could see what percentage increase would stabilize that from year to year. Okay, then I'm not going to work on that, but I will support you working on it and hope that it's something we can implement into the bill.
I've got great mathematicians.
Excellent. Polymaths in the fifth floor. Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. And really, I just had a comment and an observation that I've been wanting to make. And I sit on the Department of Administration's Finance Subcommittee meeting about OPA and the public defenders. And we have been hearing year after year of how they have had such a high turnover. And it's so stressful to families. And I'm so glad to hear the conversation today because it is really harming children and others. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Clayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot of, there's sort of three different parts working in terms of trying to increase size. Would it potentially be simpler, although it would bring a significant fiscal note to this bill, would it potentially be simpler to kind of not have the bonus thing in the budget, but instead make the effective date of this bill the 1st of July, which is the 1st of this next fiscal year, and put a 25% raise in?
Through the chair, that would be simpler, but I must tell you, I find it so challenging. Now, this is a personal statement, because clearly people get bills turned into law, and I've had that experience myself. But it is darn challenging to do that. And we are on day 75. So if the administration in its comments to me that it saw the problem is serious because they have the bully pulpit, then this could become law. But I don't know.
More comment than a question. I will just note, we sat in Department of Law subcommittee, and every time they were in front of us, I asked them where they stood on your bill, and they could never answer the question. And I think about the essential need for resources in the field, and prosecutors and police and troopers are at the top of the list, and you know, they can't get on board with a bill that says 10% next year, much less a bill that says it's a problem today, and the longer you wait, it gets worse. So I hear that concern. That may be a reason to take a multi-pronged approach, but I'm also concerned that even what we're talking about now is we've got to get something else going to make the bonuses effective according to both lawyers. So that requires passing legislation too, which could make everybody's head spin. So obviously I support these efforts. I think it goes beyond Department of Law and lawyers, but it's a challenge that we face. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate the effort on the bill. And I'll continue to look at that effective date question because there's a level at which it strikes me it makes more sense. Just look, we got to get the raise in, make it effective this year and pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have not let go of the notion of us having a long-term fiscal plan. And, my question is, to the sponsor, do you know if DOA or anyone has taken a look at the fuller picture of our state employees and what the counterpart, salary is? Because obviously we've identified this is not just a problem with our attorneys, which this bill is very focused on that, and I appreciate, but like, for instance, we haven't been able to hire people in my district in DOT to be able to plow roads because they can make so much more, running their own blade or working for a private contractor. And we're not able to meet the services that people demand. And I'm all about shrinking our budget, but also providing that basic, and when we're talking in this area of justice, it's a great concern. So do you know if anyone has taken a look at the fuller picture of what we're facing in the state?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I don't. But what I do know is that I hear the two words, the dreaded word, salary study, and a couple or three lucky agencies get one. And all I hear is the word delay and postponement. Meanwhile, there's the churn. And you're right. I mean, by the way, the committee may not know this, but the governor adopted my HES subcommittee's recommendation for OCS bonuses, using the exact number we used that had previously been vetoed. But at any rate, this is a problem across the departments. In some cohorts, it's not a problem, I think, and in others, it certainly is. And I've wondered myself whether, because I get impatient with this two-year process, whether there couldn't be a grand summit at the University of Alaska Fairbanks where all the agencies just hammered this out and said, this is what we need to do. But unfortunately, I'm not hearing anything about that.
Okay. Follow up.
I
just want to follow up with a statement for clarity for the public based upon what we've heard in subcommittee, specifically with the attorneys, is there's some areas of the state that it's more affordable for us to contract those services out than to do it ourselves. This area is not one of them, and it's much more affordable based upon what we've learned in subcommittee to hire in-house and be able to do much of that work, and still we're woefully behind. So I just wanted to clarify that for anyone who may be wondering, as we look at the bigger picture, but obviously we have to take one bite at a time.
And I would just add, I also have not lost hope for long-term fiscal plan either. Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair. And I just have to make a comment again, because living in the capital city, I work with and hear from a lot of people who work for state government and hear from many families, and some families would like one parent to stay home with their child and children, and it is getting so unaffordable on what we are offering to employees, and that really greatly concerns me. And I'm sure, obviously we have a lot of state employees across the state, and so this is really an important subject. Thank you.
Additional questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Representative Josephson, Ms. Reardon, for pinch hitting for a few questions, as well as Ms. Thornburg online for the presentation. I think this is sort of rich for committee interaction with the sponsor, and I will just await word from the sponsor committee members when it feels like we want to take further action on this, if there's amendments or CS or anything like that. So we can follow the committees and the sponsors' lead in that regard. And speaking of further action, next week is a bills previously heard heavy schedule, in part because of uncertainty around the floor, but do want to maximize consideration of legislation, including perhaps this legislation, next week, as well as other bills previously heard. So as soon as we sort of have a little bit more clarity what the schedule may look like, we'll notify committee accordingly. And that includes time, so we may delay to the evening if we're on floor at 3 o'clock. And just a note that we are noticed for next Saturday at 10 a.m. For state affairs. And again, can be in touch whether that meeting does or does not come to fruition. So with all of that noted, thank you, Sophia, who's online, and Lydia in the back room, and Jeff, for facilitating today's hearing. And at 4:32, we are adjourned.